Let us pray. Creating Spirit, you made the earth to be always in motion, never static, forever unfolding. As the earth spins on her axis and we move again into a new season, along with the leaves and the ground and the creatures, meet us in our transition and tend to those parts of ourselves and our communities that are unsettled, in upheaval, changing, stretching, and becoming.
The scripture reading for today, if I can find it, comes from Jeremiah 6:16. And it says, "Stand at the crossroads and look. Stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for ancient paths. Ask where the good way is and walk in it. And you will find rest for your souls." Stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is and walk in it. And you will find rest for your souls. Now, rest was not exactly what Eustace Scrubb found when his cousins, the Pevensies, came to visit his home. And I'm going to read a little excerpt from The Voyage of the Dawn Treader by C.S. Lewis. It's actually one of my favorite books. And for the last 3 months or so, actually maybe 6 months, I have felt a little bit like Eustace Scrubb. So I'll give a little description of him. "There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrubb, and he almost deserved it. His parents called him Eustace Clarence, and his schoolmasters called him Scrubb. I can't tell you how his friends spoke to him, for he had none. He didn't call his father and mother, but Harold and Alberta. They were very up-to-date and advanced people. They were vegetarians, non-smokers, and teetotalers, and all wore a special kind of underclothes. In their house, there was little furniture and very few clothes on the beds, and the windows were always open. Eustace Clarence liked animals, especially beetles, if they were dead and pinned on a card. He liked books if they were books of information, and he had pictures of grain elevators or of fat children doing exercises in model schools. Eustace Clarence disliked his cousins, the four Pevensies, Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy, but he was quite glad when he heard that they were coming to stay. For deep down inside, he liked bossing and bullying, and though he was a puny little person who couldn't have stood up even to Lucy, let alone Edmund, in a fight, he knew that there are dozens of ways to give people a bad time if you're in your own home and they are only visitors." So this is where we pick up Eustace's story. And Eustace is up in the attic. You can picture a little attic room, actually very similar to the one that Dave and I are staying in. And his cousins are talking about some travels that they've had right out of this world to the land of Narnia. And they're whispering in secret whispers, for one of the pictures on the wall in that room reminds them of the ships that they used to sail when they were in the land of Narnia. And Eustace, being a very practical boy who liked only details and things spelled out for him in a very specific way, came in and thought that they were making up fairy stories and began to tease and tease them. And when he came in and began to tease them, he said, "Ah, I see that you like this picture on the wall." And he said, "What do you like about it?" thinking that he could get a little bit more to tease them with. And they said, "Well, look at it, the water. It looks like it's coming right out of the picture. It looks like it's actually moving." And at that moment, Eustace looked over, and indeed, the water looked like it was moving. So much so that he stepped back, and right as he stepped back, the water splashed out of the frame, and he began to yell, stop it, make it stop. But he ran forward, and as he ran forward to try to tear the painting off of the wall, something very strange happened. He was sucked right into that painting, along with his cousins who chased after him. And the next thing he knew, he was standing on the edge of the painting. and a huge wave came and swiped him off into the sea. And the door to his world closed behind him. This is very much how I have been feeling about the transition to Holden Village. I feel like we came up the boat on the boat, and you could not actually even see the mountains on the sides. It was so smoky. It smelled terrible. I was coughing the whole way, feeling kind of sorry for myself because I'd had to say goodbye to so many people. And of all of those things that I had built attachments around, my job, my status in the community, my friendships, being a homeowner. There were all of these things, all of these responsibilities that I had been holding with a very tight fist. And like Eustace, when I came to this world, the Holden world, I was actually pretty grouchy. And I'm a pastor's kid, so many of you may not have noticed that because we learned to put on very nice smiley faces. But as my husband could probably attest, I was complaining. I cried a lot. I had little temper tantrums myself. And this is kind of where we catch Eustace. So he's in Narnia with the Pevensey children, and the Pevenseys have already been on adventures. So the excitement has mounted in them. And as they look up from the water, they see this beautiful ship that they had been watching in the picture. And people are diving off of the side of the ship to gather them up and bring them on board. And as you can imagine, Eustace is completely freaked out. He's never really learned how to swim, so he's grabbing onto Lucy and pulling her under and trying to make himself buoyant on the top, to the point where the Prince Caspian, who comes to rescue him, has to pull Eustace off and tell him to back off. And then they gather them all up into the ship, and Eustace is complaining and yelling and threatening to call the Coast Guard and saying, "Let me out of here, let me out of here, I want to go home." Well, he does this, not just in this moment, but for the next several weeks of their voyage, until they have a huge storm that they face, and the mast of the ship is split and falls down onto the ship, and they finally limp along until they see land, and when they see land, everyone's cheering, for they've run out of rations. They have no more food aboard. They have no mast to get them anywhere. And so they row as hard as they can to get to this island. And when they get there, Eustace is still in a terrible temper. Everyone else is helping. They're pitching in. They're helping to get things ready. They're trying to find a mast for the ship, find food, and Eustace sneaks off. He goes up into the hills, up and over a precipice and down a steep embankment. And soon the clouds come in and he can't really see where he's going. The whole way he's complaining, he's saying all the negative things he can think about, how it's like slave labor to make him work for them. Well, as he's coming down, the clouds lift and he finds himself in a valley and he sees this place where he's been walking. And it's right on a sheer cliff. Very hard to get back up. And right as he's sitting there, he turns, and out of the side of a cave comes the most unexpected thing. It's a dragon. Eustace could not believe it. He sat very still. He'd never seen or heard of a dragon, for he was a boy who only knew about the plain and ordinary things. And so he didn't even know what to call it. But he kept thinking to himself, if I'm just quiet, it won't notice me. But he had begun to be so thirsty, and the dragon had gone out to the pond that was in the middle of that valley. And Eustace thought, however am I going to get a drink? And he sat and watched, and the dragon went to the pond, and it took one last drink of water and fell to the ground and died, for it was a very old dragon, and smoke that had been pouring out of its nose went away, and blood poured from its mouth. And Eustace sat for a very long time and watched until his thirst overtook him and he decided that he needed to go. And he went down to the water to get his drink. And when he went past the dragon, he gave it a little shove and it didn't move. And he almost felt like he had killed it. He felt kind of triumphant in that moment and got himself a drink and then went into the cave that was next, for it had started to rain, and he thought, I need some shelter. I won't be able to make it back up that steep climb in the rain. I'll just wait here a while. But being a boy who didn't know anything about dragons, he didn't expect what he found in that cave, for it was the dragon's cave, and it was filled with gold. And he began to think greedy thoughts to himself of what he could do with the gold in that land. And he pushed a bracelet all the way up above his elbow, and there he wore it, and he stuffed his pockets full of jewels and diamonds. And then, being tired from his long climb, he laid down and went to sleep. And this is where we pick him up, because this is another part of his transition. Meanwhile, Eustace slept and slept and slept. What woke him was the pain in his arm. The moon was shining in the mouth of the cave, and the bed of treasures seemed to have grown much more comfortable. In fact, he could hardly feel it at all. He was puzzled by the pain in his arm at first, but presently it occurred to him that the bracelet, which he had shoved up his elbow, had become strangely tight. His arm must have swollen while he was asleep. It was his left arm. He moved his right arm in order to feel his left, but stopped before he had moved it an inch and bit his lip in terror. For just in front of him and a little to his right, where the moonlight fell clear on the floor of the cave, he saw a hideous shape moving. He knew that shape. It was the dragon's claw. It had moved as he had moved his hands and became still when he stopped moving his hand. Oh, what a fool I've been, thought Eustace. Of course the brute had a mate, and it's lying beside me. For several minutes, he did not dare to move a muscle. He saw two thin columns of smoke going up before his eyes, black against the moonlight, just as there had been smoke coming from the other dragon's nose before it died. This was so alarming that he held his breath. The two columns of smoke vanished, and when he could hold his breath no longer, he let it out stealthily. Instantly, two jets of smoke appeared again. But even yet, he had no idea of the truth. Presently, he decided that he would edge very cautiously to his left and try to creep out of the cave. Perhaps the creature was asleep. But anyway, it was his only chance. But of course, before he edged to the left, he looked to the left, and oh, to his horror, there was a dragon's claw on the left side too. No one will blame Eustace if at this moment he shed tears. He was surprised at the size of his own tears and as he saw them splashing on the treasure in front of him. They also seemed to be strangely hot, and steam went up from them. But there was no good crying. He must try to crawl out from between the two dragons. He began to extend his right arm, and the dragon's foreleg and claw on his right went as though in exactly the same motion. Then he thought he would try his left, and the dragon limb on that side moved too. Two dragons, he thought, one on each side, mimicking whatever he did. His nerve broke, and he simply made a bolt for it. There was such a clatter and rasping and clinking of gold and grinding of stones. As he rushed out of the cave, that he thought they were both following him. He daren't look back. He rushed to the pool. The twisted shape of the dread dragon, lying in the moonlight, would have been enough to frighten anyone, but now he hardly noticed it. His idea was to get into the water, but just as he reached the edge of the pool, two things happened. First of all, it came over him like a thunderclap that he had been running on all fours, and why on earth had he been doing that? And secondly, as he bent towards the water, he thought for a second that yet another dragon was staring up at him out of the pool. But in an instant he realized the truth. The dragon's face in the pool was his own reflection. There was no doubt of it. It moved as he moved. It opened and shut its mouth as he opened and shut his mouth. He had turned into a dragon while he was asleep, sleeping on a dragon's hoard with greedy, dragonish thoughts in his heart. He had become a dragon himself. Now, in transition, this often happens to us. We're grouchy with the people that we love. We grasp on to things that we think are important, and we lose sight of the things that are really important. And Eustace had to go back to his friends in this condition to his cousins who he had treated so poorly. And his dragon that actually had been on the inside had become his outside flesh. And he thought, how are they going to recognize me? What am I going to do? How am I going to get help? Is there any way to cure this? And so he went out, and they came upon the cousins, and one of the cousins began to talk to him because he wasn't acting like a normal dragon acted. And they asked him if he was an enchanted prince, and he shook his head, and he tried to write in the sand, "It's me, Eustace, and I'm stuck. I'm in this body." Well, when they discovered it was him, they all felt sorry for him. And Eustace began to transform. The inward dragon that became outward began to calm and be reassuring and kind. And he began to help the people that were around him in ways that he would have never thought to help them before. For they poured compassion on him. And Reepy Cheep the Mouse, who I encourage you all to read this book, he had been particularly beastly to in his first few weeks of their travel. And the mouse sat with him every night and comforted him and talked to him about being different. And so this unique friendship began to develop. And one night, after the inside of Eustace had begun to transform, he came upon Aslan. And I want to read to you what Aslan did. "Fire ahead," Edmund said. "Well, last night I was more miserable than ever, and that beastly arm ring was hurting like anything. Is that all right now?" Eustace laughed a different kind of laugh from any Edmund had ever heard him give before, and slipped the bracelet easily off his arm. "Here it is," he said, "and anyone who likes can have it, as far as I'm concerned. Well, as I say, I was lying awake and wondering what on earth would become of me. And then, but mind you, it may have been a dream, I don't know." "Go on," said Edmund with considerable patience. "Well, anyway, I looked up and saw the very last thing I expected, a huge lion coming slowly towards me. And one queer thing was that there was no moonlight last night. But there was moonlight where the lion was. It came nearer and nearer. I was terribly afraid of it. You may think that being a dragon, I could have knocked any lion out easily enough. But it wasn't that kind of fear. I wasn't afraid of it eating me. I was just afraid of it, if you can understand. Well, it came closer up to me and looked straight into my eyes, and I shut my eyes tight. But that wasn't any good because it told me to follow it."
"You mean that it spoke?"
"I don't know, now that you mention it. I don't think that it did. But it told me all the same, and I knew that I'd have to do exactly what it told me. So I got up and followed it, and it led me along the mountains. And there was always this moonlight over and around the lion wherever it went, so that at last we came to the top of the mountain I'd never seen before, and on the top of this mountain there was a garden, trees, fruit, and everything. In the middle of it, there was a well. I knew it was a well because you could see the water bubbling up from the bottom of it, but it was a lot bigger than most wells, like a very big round bath with marble steps going down into it. The water was clear as anything, and I thought if only I could get in there and bathe in it, it would ease the pain in my leg. But the lion told me I must undress first. Mind you, I don't know if he said any words out loud or not. I was just going to say that I couldn't undress because I hadn't any clothes on, when I suddenly thought that dragons are snaky sort of things, and snakes can cast their skins. Of course, I thought, that's what the lion means. So I started scratching myself, and my scales began coming off all over the place. And then I scratched a little deeper, and instead of just scales coming off here and there, my whole skin started peeling off beautifully, like it does after an illness, or as if I was stepping out of a banana. In a minute or two, I just stepped out of it, and I could see it lying there beside me, looking rather nasty. It was the most lovely feeling. So I started to go down into the well for my bath. But just as I was going to put my foot into the water, I looked down and saw that it was all hard and rough and wrinkled and scaly, just as it had been before. "Oh, that's all right," said I. "It only means I had another smaller suit underneath the first one. I'll have to get out of that too." So I scratched and tore and scratched again, and this underskin peeled off beautifully, and out I stepped and left it lying beside the other.
and went down to the well for my bath. Well, exactly the same thing happened again. And I thought to myself, oh dear, however many skins have I got to take off? For I was longing to bathe my leg. So I scratched away for the third time and got off the third skin just like the two others and stepped out of it. But as soon as I looked at myself in the water, I knew it had been no good. Then the lion said, but I don't know if he exactly spoke. You will have to let me undress you. I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you, but I was pretty nearly desperate now. So I just lay flat down on my back and let him do it. The first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right to my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I'd ever felt. The only thing that made me able to bear it was the pleasure of feeling the stuff peel off finally. You know, like if you've ever picked a scab of a sore place, it hurts like a billy-o, but it's such fun to see it coming away. I know exactly what you mean, said Edmund. Well, he peeled the beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I had done it myself. The other three times, only they hadn't hurt. And there it was lying on the grass, only ever so much thicker and darker and more knobbly looking than the others had been. And there I was, smooth and soft as a peeled switch and smaller than I had been. Then he caught hold of me. I didn't like it much, for I was very tender underneath now that I had no skin on, and he threw me into the water. It smarted like anything, but only for a moment. And after that, it became perfectly delicious. And as soon as I started swimming and splashing, all the pain had gone from my arm. Then I saw why, for I had turned into a boy again. You'd think me simply phony if I told you how I felt about my own arms. I know they've no muscle and are pretty moldy compared with Caspian's, but oh my, I was glad to see them. After a bit, the lion took me out and dressed me. Dressed you? With his paws? Well, I don't exactly remember that bit, but he did somehow or another, in new clothes, the same I've got on now, as a matter of fact, and then suddenly I was back here, which is what makes me think it must have been a dream. No, said Edmund, it wasn't a dream. Well, why not? For there are the clothes for one thing, and you have been, well, undragoned for another. So I like to think of Holden in some ways as the undragoning process for me. Coming here, I've only been here 4 days, and walking in nature, seeing God's creation, watching the deer, hearing the sound of the water, and being with each and every one of you, hearing your stories at the tables, is undoing some of the dragon that's built up inside of me. And I've been thinking a lot about coming at the end of summer. So I've missed all of the hard work of summer. The staff here has worked lots of hours and are probably quite tired. And as we're transitioning into August and some of the bigness of the village begins to fall away, I just wanted to encourage each and every one of us to care for one another in this process, because some of those dragons of transition might rise and we might act grumpy towards each other or be frustrated about this thing or that thing that happens. And that each and every one of us can be undragoned by one another's actions. And so with that, I conclude my talk. And I actually forgot to give you the thing I was supposed to give you, but thank you so much.
Though the earth shall change, though the mountains tremble, though the waters rage, you, God, are here. Though the nations war, though the peoples battle, though the empire falters, we will not fear. Though the earth shall change,
though the earth shall change,
though the mountains tremble,
though the mountains tremble,
though the waters rage,
though the waters rage,
you, God, are here.
You, God, are here.
Though the nations war,
though the nations war,
people battles,
though the people battle,
though the empire falters,
though the empire falters,
we will not fear.
We will not fear. Though the nations shall change, though the mountains tremble,
and receive this blessing. Above all, trust in the slow work of God. We are quite naturally impatient in everything to reach the end without delay. We should like to skip the intermediate stages. We are impatient of being on the way to something unknown, something new. And yet, it is the law of all progress that it is made by passing through some stages of instability, and that it may take a very long time. And so I think it is with you. Your ideas mature gradually. Let them grow. Let them shape themselves without undue haste. Don't try to force them on as though you could be today what time, that is to say, grace and circumstances, acting on your own goodwill, will make of you tomorrow. Only God could say what this new spirit gradually forming within you will be. Give our Lord the benefit of believing that his hand is leading you, and accept the anxiety of feeling yourself in suspense and incomplete.
We are sent forth tonight into the twilight singing these words: when you walk from here, when you walk from here, walk with justice, walk with mercy, and with God's humble care. Please rise as you are able and join us when you feel comfortable. From here,
when you walk from here, when you walk from here, walk with justice, walk with mercy, and with God's humble care. Walk with mercy. and with God's humble
thanks be to God.